is a thief. Matt Foley is a liar and a big old jerk. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. Matt Foley is the president of Moturn Media, a terrible organization that I very much hate. Oh, I came up with a very good idea for an album. I said, hey, boss, what do you say I do an album about animal poop? And Matt Foley, that's my boss, he said, that's a very good idea. Get out of my face, I'm going to steal your idea, give it to somebody else. So, Matt Foley stole my brilliant idea, and he gave it to the odd man who sings about poop.
War is pointless and horrifying, and people die for no reason. Like, that's the thesis of the book. That's the thesis of the movie. And, like, the fact that you would have a remote to, like, pause that and take a break, it kind of, like, defeats the purpose of the movie.
Absolutely.
I think his politics are great.
Okay.
Edward Berger's politics are great. Because it's interesting how he kind of, like, had that conservative cardinal, and Stanley Tucci is kind of like the liberal cardinal. But as a filmmaker, Berger's obviously critical of both. And then he kind of, the person who ends up getting elected pope is basically the people's pope, who is in war zones all the time, helping those in need. And everybody seems to be getting along with it. I think that I support subverting a studio movie with your politics in a way that pisses people off, but you don't always have to piss people off or divide people. You can be clear in your politics and have everybody agree with you, and that's pretty cool too. And so far, like, I have a lot of Catholic friends, my parents, aunts and uncles who are, like, Catholic and on the conservative end, not of Catholicism, like, because conservative end of Catholicism is like going back to Latin Mass. You know what I mean? They all really love the movie and its message. So I was like, that's pretty cool.
The vaping cardinal definitely would have won the election. That's where I had to suspend my belief. I mean, we talked about Conclave on last week's episode. Brody and I did. So if anybody wants to hear that, go check that one out.
I have to hear the vaping conclave.
I think as far as, like, Oscar movies go, or in terms of things that are, like, projected to be nominated for Best Picture, I mean, this would certainly be the least embarrassing option. But I'm a little bit curious about your greater thoughts on Edward Berger as a director, because this was the first movie of his that I had seen. You know, I did not watch the All Quiet on the Western Front remake that he did a couple years ago, and I hadn't been familiar with him at all before that came out. I'd like to hear a little bit more about what you think about him, and, you know, what your history with him is, even if it is brief.
Totally, yeah. So I was able to see a screening of All Quiet on the Western Front, like an Academy screening, which was pretty cool. So I got to see it in a movie theater. To me, that was one of the big tragedies about All Quiet on the Western Front. For those who don't know, it's a famous novel based on World War I, and it's a very anti-war novel and subsequently film adaptations. And Edward Berger's is the most recent, and I think it might be the first one in German, the country that it was written in. Yeah, I really like Edward Berger. I loved All Quiet on the Western Front. I thought it was a great movie. I thought his politics are very clear, that war is pointless. People die for no reason. And it is a 24/7 horror show. I still think about this movie today. You know, one of the tragedies is that it was on Netflix. Sorry, Netflix. It's just the kind of film that really lends itself to the masses seeing it in a theater, because when you're at home, you know, you see a lot of jarring images and horrifying images repeating over and over again for pretty much the duration of the film. So when you're watching it at home, you obviously have a remote, you can pause it, you can go do other things, you can take a break from the horrifying images, which kind of, like, defeats the purpose of the film to me, because the people in the film don't have an escape, you know, neither should you. So, yeah, I thought it was a great anti-war film. I really dug it. I know a lot of people were really critical of the soundtrack in that film. They said it was, like, very repetitive, but to me, I was like, that's a fucking point. Like, it was just very few chords being repeated over and over again, which to me served the entire, you know, thesis of the film. It's a very repetitive movie. anti-war movie. War sucks. People die for no reason. And it's terrifying. Personally, I'm down to see something like that, you know?
Absolutely.
As someone who is anti-war. So, yeah. So then I was like, okay, cool. I dug it. So I was excited for Conclave.
I'm curious how that impacts your views on like anti-war cinema in general, because that has been a long conversation that cinephiles and filmmakers have had for a very long time as to, you know, whether anti-war films can even exist, or if they can, you know, what that actually means. Because I feel like the movie that I've seen the most disagreement about in that regard, at least among like popular audiences, would be Saving Private Ryan. Steven Spielberg in general, he's sort of a lightning rod within this conversation because of that movie, as well as Schindler's List. A lot of the critics of Saving Private Ryan, you know, the people who support that as sort of a quote-unquote anti-war movie, I think just say it as, you know, this depicts the like hellish experience of war, and therefore it is an anti-war movie because they watch it and they wouldn't want to be there. But when it comes to like a mainstream American filmmaker like that, or in Spielberg's case, really America's director, I think he has sort of tried to establish that lane for himself. It raises a lot of questions about, you know, how Hollywood and the military-industrial complex can impact one another, you know, how certain Hollywood movies drum up support for America's actions overseas, you know, and like when you have movies like that and you attach sentimentality to its characters or to the experience as a whole of going to war and portraying it as this noble, brave thing, I mean, that goes a long way towards losing the goodwill that you built up by, you know, portraying D-Day as particularly hellish. Or I brought up Schindler's List as well. I mean, a number of French directors I know of have been very critical, especially of that shower scene in which it dramatizes some of the most egregious actions in the Holocaust. And, you know, Jean-Luc Godard satirized Spielberg pretty viciously for doing so in his movie In Praise of Love. And then there was that Michael Haneke interview where he's talking about, you know, to me, dramatizing the Holocaust is unspeakable. You know, there are certain things that you cannot capture with a movie camera, especially if you're manipulating that in service of a commercial film, ultimately. And that interview went so viral because directly after he said that, they cut to John Krasinski, who didn't know what the hell anyone was talking about. I don't actually know what I make of what Michael Haneke was saying in that clip. Like, I think there's certain truths to it, but also some of the critiques of Spielberg in that regard may have been taken a bit too far. But it's sort of a long-winded way of looping back to asking what your thoughts are on anti-war cinema. You know, is it possible for one? And if so, does Edward Berger fall into that lane?
Well, for one, I'm really glad that you brought up the Michael Haneke bit in that Variety or Vanity Fair roundtable. Was it directors or screenwriters?
It was directors on directors, I think.
Directors on directors. Well, he has another quote. He says, pornography, it seems to me, is no different from war films or propaganda films, in that it tries to make the visceral, horrific, or transgressive elements of life consumable. And he kind of puts war films and pornography kind of on the same plane. You know, it's also subjective, but for where I'm at in my life and where I've been in my life the last few years, I'm like very much against anti-war films and war films in general. I have no interest in seeing movies that try to make war consumable or entertainment. That's kind of where I'm at, and that's where I'm still at. However, there are always exceptions to the rule, or you find yourself getting invited to seeing All Quiet on the Western Front through a friend, and you're at the screening, and so you have zero expectations. This is not a movie I would have probably gone out on my own to see had I not been invited to that. And sort of my exception to the rule and like my preference is an anti-war film I'm more okay with when it's quite literally almost like a propaganda anti-war film. Like, it's pretty much every single second is dedicated to being anti-war. To me, I felt that Berger's All Quiet on the Western Front was more in that category. Yes, it was a Netflix movie. Yes, it got nominated for 10, 12 Oscars. I think a lot of people didn't like the repetitive nature of the film, and to me made it a little less easily consumable. And I think when you're making it difficult for an audience to consume something in an entertaining way, especially when you're dealing with a subject like the war, you know, then I think you're on the right path as a filmmaker or artist. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. That makes all the sense in the world. I think you articulated that very well. We went a little bit longer on that than I expected to, but that's what we do, because this is Mudville at the Movies, episode number 5. It's been a little while since we've brought one of these to you, but very excited to have you back, Tony, be able to talk about some really great films with you. As always, I am one of your hosts, Nolan Raybon.
And I'm Tony Brown. It's a beautiful day for the movies.
We've got a really exciting episode for you guys today. We're talking about the new film from one of my favorite voices in all of American independent cinema right now, Matt Farley of Moturn Media, who some of you may remember was on our podcast last year talking about his film, Heard She Got Murdered. Well, now he's got a new one. It is Local Legends Bloodbath. It is the sequel to, I think, his most critically acclaimed film from 2013, Local Legends, which I'm going to talk about in a bit. We've got quite a bit to discuss in regard to that whole cinematic universe of sorts. But before we get into all that, Tony, you saw a film today that you wanted to talk about on the pod. Why don't you kick us off?
Yeah, I'm not going to go too depth into the movie, which I found was wonderful, but I just wanted to issue a PSA from filmmaker Payal Kapadia for her film All We Imagine as Light. She went on Twitter this weekend and she stated that her movie is being stretched by projectionists. So if the cinema, she says on Twitter, if the cinema you see the film in has the wrong aspect ratio, please report to the projectionist. Her aspect ratio for All We Imagine as Light, the AR is 11.66. It's flat, not scope. So basically the image should not be stretched. If you see something like the subtitles aren't on the screen, or if you see the actors look all stretched, please, she insists, and I insist, that you go to the projectionist, someone running the theater, and ask to restart with the right aspect ratio, and don't be shy about it.
Well, speaking of Jean-Luc Godard, you're doing your best impression of Jean-Pierre Lode's character in Masculine Feminine there, where he notices the wrong aspect ratio and complains to the cinema crew. Truly doing your duty as a cinephile, Tony. I'm very proud of you. How did you feel about the movie All We Imagine is Light? You don't have to get too much into it, but just sort of in general, thumbs up.
Definitely. R.I.P. Roger Ebert forever. It's funny that you say that, because Payal Kapadia on Twitter screenshots that scene in the Masculine Feminine with Jean-Pierre Léaud, and it's like literally the images in the subtitles being like, shit, it's the wrong aspect ratio. I'm going to go complain. So you both got that reference. And yeah, no, it's a fabulous film that kind of goes into the lives of three women of different ages in contemporary modern day Mumbai. It's a very beautiful piece.
And is there anything else that you've seen in the past couple of weeks that you want to talk about before we get into this?
Yeah, well, recently I got to just quickly recommend Taking Off, Milos Forman. It's the first film that he made in Hollywood when he came to America, and it's his first Hollywood movie, and as someone who's giving the intro at Anthology Film Archive said, it's his last Czech New Wave film, so it's still got that, you know, rapid edits, cuts, juxtapositioning of the Czech New Wave. Fabulous film. Buck Henry steals the show. Definitely recommend Taking Off by Milos Forman. And then for kind of like a mainstream release, dude, I love Trap. M. Night Shyamalan. That was only the second M. Night Shyamalan film I've ever seen. I had only seen Signs prior to that.
Wow.
And yeah, I know he's kind of a blind spot for me, but again, it's more like a preference thing where no one's ever really invited me to go to an M. Night Shyamalan film with them. You know, his just gets away from me. I did try seeing The Sixth Sense, but I already knew the spoiler, so that kind of ruined it for me. Yeah, so I had only seen Signs. I love Trap. I think Trap is one of the best films of the year. I think it's a self-reflexive, avant-garde film that M. Night Shyamalan has gifted to us in the midst of pretty bleak IP franchise, ugly digital filmmaking that we're kind of finding ourselves in. But we can't control when a filmmaker releases a masterpiece. I think about Trap daily.
I love Trap. I mean, that's also one of my favorite releases of the year. I think I talked about it with Brody at some point over the summer. I don't remember exactly when, but I know that we did discuss that one on the pod as well. I had so much fun with it. Shyamalan, I completely agree. He's done an incredible job in a landscape which does not reward individuality and originality or, like making decisions that might be immediately rejected or scorned by more closed-minded audiences or critic that sort
in,
of
in an audience that's kind of been conditioned to be kind of
exactly. He's done a great job of remaining himself, truly original, and you know, making the movies that he wants to make when he wants to make them with the people he wants to make them with. And I mean, we're going to talk about that with Matt Farley's movie today, but that is really something that has to be rewarded, you know, just at this time where it feels like producers just control everything and are able to put creativity in a box and shape it into their own sort of monstrosities. I mean, Shyamalan, with the exception of The Last Airbender, has never allowed one of his films to become that, I don't think. And, you know, that The Last Airbender is certainly something that he's learned quite a bit from and did quite a long time ago. But the last, like, 8 years of Shyamalan's career, starting with Split, I mean, I think it's just been sort of banger after banger. I completely agree with you there, though. I mean, Trap might be something that we end up talking about again in, like, a month when we're doing our top 10 of the year. I had a couple of new movies that I saw as well. I don't want to go too long on these, but I felt like I would mention them because one certainly will not be mentioned at the end of the year, and another one I would be sort of surprised, but one of these I really liked quite a bit, and the other one I truly did not. And I guess I will get the bad one out of the way first. I saw Emilia Perez, the new film from Jacques Audiard, which really stunk. I was just truly baffled by how one misstep after another could be treated as, you know, one of the leading Best Picture candidates moving forward. And something where, you know, I had no reaction to other than, who is this for? Zoe Saldana, like, plays this lawyer where in the first 10 minutes we see that, you know, she has to be in court with some of these particularly, like, seedy clients. Like, the first guy that she sees is accused of killing his wife, and you see how easily the court system that she's working within gets this guy off and basically acts like, oh, there's no chance he did this. This was an accident. This was a suicide. I mean, just truly wrong-headed outcome being treated like it's just sort of like the air. And she's approached by Manitas, this sort of gang member who's, you know, has a ton of history of violence. And he comes to her and says, I'd like to be a woman. I want to have a sex change, and I don't want anybody to know. None of my rivals, of course, but none of my colleagues, none of my family even. And he tasks her with pulling off this Herculean task of accommodating this surgery for him and creating this new life for him where he's able to escape, you know, everything that he's ever known. And the movie jumps 4 years, and when he's now a woman, Emilia Perez, the title character. And then it turns into this, like, crime drama, essentially. But I was just particularly baffled by the musical elements in this movie, which really just did not work one bit. I mean, it's one of those musicals where very, you know, common dialogue, like, that doesn't particularly rhyme is still done in, like, sing-song form or is turned into a melody. And that's something that's never really worked for me, like, even in good movies. Like, I don't even really particularly enjoy that style in, like, The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, which I know is kind of a sin to say. Just that I don't think that singing every line of dialogue is always particularly, like, the way to go. Like, I don't mind just, you know, seeing characters talking how they, like, normally would, and then when it goes into a song that's going to, you know, develop the plot or the characters or kind of show us something that we haven't seen before. Like, I don't mind a balance balance between, you know, just regular dialogue and then musical scenes. But I feel like when you're putting a beat behind like very conversational stuff, it doesn't always work and comes off to me as just sort of awkward. I mean, it just didn't work at all. You know, it's going for this very specific sort of tone where it has these very dark and gritty like images and themes to it, but it's also has this very uncanny, energetic musical backdrop that just to me never coalesced, never created a work of art that I felt had any sort of balance to it or any sort of nuance or even really anything to say. My ultimate takeaway from this was that it was trying so hard to fit itself into the zeitgeist, either with being a trans movie, quote unquote, just because it features a character who has a sex change, or that it wants to, you know, take on these real world issues of, you know, violence against women. Like, you know, there are a few scenes in there where Emilia Perez becomes this activist against cartel violence and this advocate for saving women, which I thought those were the most successful scenes in the whole movie. Like, I would have liked to have seen more of that. It dedicates so much time to Selena Gomez's character is Manita slash Amelia's ex-wife who gets involved with other people that were in Manitas's like gang fear, and ultimately, you know, leads this down to its climax. And, you know, I think that that's stuff is like decent, like it works okay, but combining it with these like very flashy and uncanny sort of singing performances from like Zoe Saldana or from whoever else, I mean, it just didn't work for me at all. And I think it would be a completely embarrassing Best Picture winner, which is why I project it to win. That or September 5th, one of those two movies is going to take it, but I'd prefer Conclave. That's all I'll say. Did not care for Emilia Perez at all, but I did like Robert Zemeckis's Here quite a bit. I missed that one. And that was not one that I was really expecting to like very much. I feel like Zemeckis over the past few years has sort of developed a reputation as a director who utilizes advancements in technology or in graphics or CGI or whatever, and usually doesn't execute it very well or turns it into a very like cheesy sort of schlock type movie. Like, I mean, I feel like the pinnacle of this is Welcome to Marwen, which I think came out in 2019, you know, a movie that was really just DOA and treated like a joke. And I guess I was sort of afraid that this would happen again for his movie Here. But I was really, really surprised by how much I enjoyed it. I mean, the whole movie is one shot. You know, when you see this living room set, that's what you're going to be looking at for almost 2 hours. And what it does that really fascinated me is it breaks off individual chunks of the screen as the movie goes on to put you into a different time setting. You know, you see the family who owns the home for multiple generations. You also see who buys the house after they have to sell it for, you'll see what reason they have to sell it for. Or you'll see the people who had the house in like the late 1800s, the people who sold the house to the family. You see it before it was a house, when the house was under construction, when neighborhoods were under construction, and you see before even society was a concept, you know, what the nature of this spot in the world looked like before it turned into a residence. And some of the juxtapositions that creates interested me a lot more than that I expected them to, and just like made me think more than I thought I was going to be thinking during a Zemeckis, Tom Hanks, Robin Wright movie. I mean, we know what Forrest Gump is like. That's not one of my favorites, but this sort of felt like it was almost a rejection of that boomer sentimentality type deal. I mean, there are certain elements of the movie where I feel like old people are going to watch it and be like, oh, isn't that sweet? But there are other moments where I'm like, oh, that is like particularly bleak and real in a way that I hadn't really seen Robert Zemeckis be too often, at least in such like a real sense, you know, or without this sort of artificiality that, I don't know, I just feel like has been particularly present in Zemeckis's past films, or Tom Hanks especially. I feel like has sort of developed a Spielbergian reputation as this guy who makes movies for middle America, And those have had all of the downsides that you would think would come with something like that or with that reputation. But there was something that just felt more raw and real and like tapped into a more nuanced view of humanity than I'm used to seeing in a lot of like Hollywood movies these days. But yeah, I particularly enjoyed here. I did not particularly enjoy Emilia Perez. And with that wrap up, why don't you say we move into the movie that we have on tap to discuss in full today, which is Matt Farley and Charlie Roxburgh's Local Legends Bloodbath. Tony, what did you think of this movie?
I just got to say, I'm the biggest Matt Farley guy because we grew up in the same area, Pride and North Shore, Massachusetts, Danvers, Massachusetts. He grew up in Danvers. I went to high school in Danvers. You know, I'm just so glad that we have this wonderful filmmaker representing my hometown for audiences to see.
I was going to ask you about that, actually. I mean, you, I feel like, got into the Moturn universe this year or within the past year or so. And being from Danvers, Massachusetts, just like Matt Farley is, like, what is it like sort of seeing that scenery in his movies? Personally, I've only ever had that experience once with The Place Behind the Pines, where I felt like I saw a lot of the like imagery and scenery that I was used to because that was shot so close to where I grew up. It's not something that I have particularly experienced in a lot of movies very often. And I'm curious what that's like for you, seeing it in this truly like independent director's work, as opposed to, you know, what it might look like in a more like official, quote unquote, like Hollywood movie. Do you have a deeper sense of connection with it? What's it like?
You know, it just kind of feels like home. The fact that he is using members from his community to star in his films gives me a little bit more personal connection because I know these people. I've seen them and I grew up with them. And I don't want to say like the people or the actors, but just kind of like the affect, the tone, the personalities, things like that.
You see people in these movies and you're like, oh, I've known people like that for my whole life.
Right.
Absolutely.
And that's super cool, especially when, you know, we're kind of dealing with non-actors in a way.
For sure.
Yeah. And then, of course, you know, whenever they bring up a North Shore roast beef sandwich, the more people are educated on that, the better.
This is the sequel to 2013's Local Legends. In that film, Farley plays sort of a fictionalized version of himself, although one with only a single very thin and see-through layer of separation between it. You know, there's a very autobiographical feel to that movie, even if it's not pure documentary. For example, Farley plays pickup basketball in that movie with his friend Soup, as they pretend to be NBA legends like Moses Malone or John Havlicek. They hire a woman who's really trying to get closer to Matt Farley in that movie to keep their stats. There are scenes where Farley will go around giving people copies of homemade CDs, DVDs. He'll take random phone calls from people who see his cell phone number listed in one of his movies or one of his songs, and they'll call to see if it's really him, you know, sort of incredulous that anyone would actually put their real life phone number into a movie like he does. And there's scenes where he has conversations with condescending extended relatives who think he doesn't know what film festivals are. So, you know, certain scenes that you get the sense clearly some sort of this variation of this happened to Farley in his real life. And then there are others that have a more tongue-in-cheek feel or indicate this is when he's stretching the truth for the comedy of the film. And the balance he created in that, I think, was pretty perfect. You know, that movie is one of the best cultural documents about what it's like to be a creator, a filmmaker, you know, anybody who tries to put their passion into their work in the 21st century, after the so-called digital revolution that seemed like it would maybe lead to more careers like Farley's. I mean, he seems to be one of the only people who are occupying the lane that he occupies. I mean, and to a larger extent, nobody does what he does. You know, Matt is prolific in multiple forms of media. Truly nobody does specifically what Matt Farley does. Crucially, within that film, there are scenes where Farley's creative side bickers with his businessman side, which is just him with his hair slicked back talking about how to make money. It's very, very funny. You know, if you haven't watched Local Legends, I mean, that's one of my biggest recommendations. I feel like you have to go watch that. You got to know what we're talking about here to understand
this.
It's
kind of a good primer for anybody who wants to get into Matt Farley and the world of Motown Media, for sure.
It's also a primer for anybody who wants to buy a $100 video camera and go around making movies with their friends. I mean, this is a guy who has sort of made a career out of that, as well as making 20,000 songs about poop. And 11 years later, Farley returns to this idea with a metatextual and self-deprecating twist where the businessman side of Matt Farley turns on his creative side and tries to kill everyone in Matt Farley's life so he has more time to create more poop songs with everyone's name in it that'll earn him more money on streaming algorithms. So this kind of picks up 11 years after the first one. And I feel like this movie really is a commentary on the amount of success, the amount of notoriety he's gained in the past couple of years, and sort of turning that on its head. I have a bit more to get into that, but I'll kick it over to you first. I mean, what were your initial takeaways from this film?
I thought, you know, the first Local Legends film to me was about the struggle as an artist and what does it mean to want to put your work out there, to be able to do this full time for a living, because he wasn't quite there yet in 2013, at least. You know, you see him working another job.
If I could cut you off to actually specify what the job that he says he works is, he was a caretaker at that time for like elderly people, I believe. You know, there's a very memorable quote from the original Local Legend where he says, if you work a job or you lead a life that allows you to create these projects when you want to and allows you to make what you want to make, it usually involves wiping an old man's butt.
Classic.
Yeah.
So, and that quote right there kind of signifies the struggle that he's going through. And when Local Legends Bloodbath starts off, we get the sense that Matt Farley has officially had a breakthrough in his career. And that's through his 25,000 songs and the idea that, you know, he made over 200K in the previous year. He no longer has to work another job for a living. He can just dedicate his life to doing art, to making music, to making films. And what you see in this breakthrough film is that you'd think that everything is gravy going forward, everything's all peaches and creams, but he still has a lot of struggle to go through. And once you are pursuing a goal and then you've kind of reached it, or you're maintaining a life that you always dreamt of living, there's an emptiness there, and there are further complications that appear throughout Local Legends Bloodbath. I think Matt is saying that, you know, just because he's achieved this goal of being a full-time artist, he's still struggling creatively with his relationships with friends as he gets older. And to me, that's very human. Not what I was expecting when I came into Bloodbath. He was kind of selling it as like he was going to ruin everything in the first movie. Like it was going to be kind of something to do, like a meditation on sequel movies or something. And it ended up being the total opposite. It just ended up being a continuation on the life of Matt Farley and to see the ups and downs and the struggles that he goes through.
What's so fascinating about this to me is that, like, you're right, it is a continuation in the life of Matt Farley, but also he did, like, totally succeed at doing all of those things that he said he was going to do. Like, if we get into sort of the plot of what this movie is, I mean, it ends with basically everyone who we met in Local Legends or who we see here is, like, one of, you know, Matt's constant friends or companions. It ends with almost all of those people dead, if not every single one of them, and ends with Matt like as this sort of new reborn version of himself who learns his friend had been sleeping with his wife because he had been such a shitty friend.
And
he has nobody
husband,
in his life.
Maybe.
Yeah, he'd been an absent husband. He'd been a bad friend. He'd been all of these things that you get the sense were put into this movie purposefully as a sort of commentary on what the idea of Matt Farley has become. You know, you get the sense that he got so much praise for this movie about being an independent filmmaker who's trying his best and making movies with his friends that he wanted to turn that on his head and say, well, this is the other side of that. You know, every time that I go out and I pursue a passion project that I spend a couple thousand dollars on and release into the world uncompromised as my own vision, you know, there's another version of me that is taking that on the chin and is seeing it as a financial failure or as investment that will bear emotional fruit, but it won't return me any money. And so I think there's a lot of that in this movie as well, but also just in that Farley character. I mean, he seems to be playing these roles now where he's very like selfish and money driven or has let fame go to his head in some way, which I think he's doing as a tongue-in-cheek way of saying, you know, I have an audience now and I've achieved a level of notoriety that I always wanted to, but I'm not a Hollywood movie star and I never will be, and I don't want that. And I think that what Local Legends Bloodbath is doing is allowing him to sort of indulge in sort of the in these excesses that you would associate with like a big star or a big rock star or a big Hollywood star. And Matt is sort of recognizing that he's achieved something that he's worked his whole life for or is in the process of achieving it or has made more progress towards achieving it in the past few years than he ever had before, while also sort of being able to poke fun at himself and at the concept of like fame or the idea of, you know, what it means to succeed in this world while still living in your hometown, making movies with your friends. He can kind of have his cake and eat it too with these ideas of what it means to be a celebrity.
My question for you is, how much do you think is actually reflective of his own life from that movie? And how much do you think is just him using that kind of celebrity Hollywood vehicle of like what happens when you make it?
Well, if I were to guess, I mean, you get a number of these recurring characters within the movie, you know, some of whom are his wife, his best friend, you know, people, fans of his work that wanted to be in this movie. So, I mean, on some level, he's never really going to cast anybody outside of his world or anybody who does, who seems like they would bring artificiality or something that's misplaced to this world that he's like so carefully created for himself. Like, you know, for example, his wife is in this movie and her character is at wit's end with him. She doesn't like watching films with him because he pokes everything apart if it's like a movie she likes and just go off and say, oh, they should have done this, they should have done that. She's sick of the poop song. She's sick of not being a priority in his life. We have his friend Tom from Moe's Haven who is going around vandalizing his flyers, writing Matt Farley, not such a nice guy after all. You know, to sort of key in that he's alienating his closest compatriots. We have a guy who wrote a script that wants Matt to be in it, and Matt is expressing frustration that this guy never actually gets his movies made, so Matt ends up reading these scripts and giving him notes, and then it doesn't actually lead anywhere. There's a friend from years ago who comes back into Matt's life and starts directing a movie of her own, which we sort of see in a couple scenes here, in which there's a very unflattering portrait of Matt, you know, portrayed by an actor who's like 30 years older than he is and is acting like a total perv or a creep. And like Matt is like, well, what the hell? That's not me. So I don't know. I think you get a lot of these sort of versions of relationships that he has in his life, but the fictionalization and cartoonishness of these relationships, I think, is increased tenfold from where it was in the first movie, which I think was closer to documentary, while this leans much more into satire.
Right. I agree. It is just interesting because for one, I think no matter what scale you're doing it on, making a movie is an incredibly difficult task. At the end of the day, Matt Farley is just a human being. Even if he still has a recurring cast, you know, what kind of tensions have arisen over the years? Has he fallen in and out of relationships with his collaborators? Is there a temptation to take things up a notch versus not? I don't know. I just found all that fascinating.
Crucially, there is another character in this movie played by a fan of Matt Farley's who I think asked to be in this film, and Matt gives him a role as this sort of like fan that drives from the Midwest to Danvers to see one of Matt's shows and ends up in jail somehow, and Matt ends up bailing this guy out of jail for like $50, ends up like hanging out with him a little bit, and this guy, I believe the character's name is Jesse, gives sort of this like menacing, almost like unhinged sort of feel that I really hadn't experienced in too many Moturn movies up to this point. I think that the Heard She Got Married, Heard She Got Murdered sequel, those two lean more into drama or, you know, giving people this sort of sense of unease that Moturn movies hadn't really done to that point. You get a good amount of that within this character. The guy who plays him, I don't have his name in front of me. I didn't see it in the credit. He does a very good job of playing this character who, once the business side of Matt Farley goes out and kills everybody else in the movie with lightning strikes, they pin the crimes on this Jesse character. And Matt just sort of ends up saying very nonchalantly, well, I guess I shouldn't have bailed him out of jail because he killed everyone in my life. And it's like, just that delivery makes me laugh so much. Just this sort of rejection of like any emotional stakes or any sort of canon within the movie. Like it's all in service of Matt being able to make the movies that he wants to make, and what happens in them sort of seems to come second almost at that point in time.
Well, one of the moments in the film that really stood out for me was a callback to a storyline in Local Legends. So when you see Local Legends, there's a woman who's trying to have a relationship with Matt Farley, but the film kind of portrays her as, you know, someone who may be emotionally manic, crazy. I hate to use those terms, but, and he just has no interest in this woman, and it's not a flattering portrayal. And if it's autobiographical in Local Legends, the first one, it's not a very flattering picture of this person. And so in Bloodbath, we see the real life person of the fictional character. We're talking layers here, folks.
We sure are.
We're seeing a real life version in Local Legends Bloodbath of the fictional portrayal in Local Legends. And now she's making her own movie telling her side of the story of what her relationship was with Matt Farley. And I thought that was spectacular.
How do you feel that those scenes reflect Matt's true emotions on certain people in his life and their images that they have of him and of what he does, like sort of how his life and career intersect with each other? Do you think he's seeing that as that he feels a little bit like uneasy about at times? Do you think that he's sort of joking about himself in those scenes? What was your takeaway from them?
You kind of get into dicey situations when you get into autofiction, because when you're writing a novel or you're making an autofiction kind of movie, people tend to trust you if you establish yourself as kind of a reliable narrator. And, you know, I think maybe in 2013, when the original Local Legends came out, this was a storyline that he felt was necessary to his own life and Local Legends into the story. And then I think, you know, 10 years removed from that situation, maybe looking back on it, maybe he thinks that he may have been too harsh on this person. And so I think this whole new thread in Bloodbath is a sign of growth for him as a filmmaker and an autofiction filmmaker, right? Because that's what both Local Legend films are, in my opinion, to some degree. Yeah, to me showed a lot of growth and maturity on his end by adding this new storyline, because there is a possibility that there are two sides to this relationship that we explored in Local Legends, and we kind of only got one side. And, you know, maybe that's not fair to the person. And I think Matt realized that. Whether or not this even happened, it could have been all fictional, and he thought it wasn't fair to the fictional person, you know. But to me, the storyline in Bloodbath showed a lot of growth.
Both of these movies, Local Legends and Local Legends Bloodbath, are to some extent auto-fiction, but I think a more cutting, biting satire than I would have come to expect from Moturn, which has always put out movies that I feel like are very genuine or very sincere. And that's not to say that this one isn't, but it's sincere in a way that I hadn't really heard or seen Matt Farley be before. And it is, like I said, you know, self-deprecating in that sense as well, where you see him reacting to the status that he's built as this cult figure of like Northeastern media or on like film Twitter. It seems to be a recognition and partial rejection.
Northeastern film Twitter, that's great.
It seems
North Shore film Twitter.
Yeah.
Me and Matt Farley.
It's just you two.
It's just us two.
That's good company to be in. This seems to be a partial rejection of the recent spike in awareness and support of his work, I mean, to which we have contributed. You know, I had Matt on the podcast. That was a lot of fun. I really love talking to him about his work. A few times he'll have dialogue in this movie like, I have my finger on the zeitgeist with this one, or here I am at my emotional nadir. And those lines sort of like indicate to me that the audience isn't supposed to put too much emotional weight behind the plot of this movie, and that Farley himself is aware of what emotional beats he's quote-unquote supposed to be hitting as a filmmaker, and ultimately disregarding them and playing them off as trivial or silly. This feels like a very calculated response to the praise he's gotten and continues to get for the original Local Legends, one that makes it very clear that there are two sides to this coin. And yeah, like when we had Farley on the podcast last year, he gave us a preview of the Moturn Media slate that was upcoming, and I joked with him that this was going to be his Twin Peaks The Return. And ultimately, that is kind of something that I thought about a lot while I was watching it. And for me, there's no higher praise than that.
I'm very well aware of the satire elements, too. But I also think Bloodbath kind of was him. I connected to a lot of the themes, and I think he was revealing stuff about himself, you know, because I don't think that everything is just like hunky-dory with him and his friends all the time, or even his wife and children. I mean, the man writes 25,000 songs. He performs it in the house. That's fucking crazy.
That's awesome.
You know? And then, but at the same time, you know, he has all these novelty songs, but he is probably most driven by his Moe's Haven work. And he thinks that no one gives a shit about. That's brutal. Even if you're making $250,000 a year.
Have you got any other thoughts on this movie, or do you want to wrap it up?
I don't. That's all I got.
I think that is going to wrap it up for me as well. I mean, at this time, this is one of my favorite movies that has released in 2024. I think this year has gone a long way to sort of solidifying the trend that I have felt over the past few years that would lead me to believe that while my 2010s list, my favorite movies of that decade, were largely dominated by aging masters or international auteurs, these major studio releases that I felt were just leaps and bounds ahead of the rest. I think my favorite films that have been put out in the past 5 years or will be released within the next five largely are going to be a lot of movies like these, you know, artistic statements that are created and put out by hardworking, dedicated people who care about their craft, who care about cinema, who care about the work that they do and the impact that it's going to have on an audience. a lot of the best films that I've seen recently and that we will talk about in a month on our favorite episodes of the year have fallen into that category. And, you know, it seems like when you're watching them, it might give off the sensation that these are some friends who went out there with a camera and made a movie. There's going to be a pretty seismic shift, I think, in what sort of art captivates people in the next 5 years compared to what has been dominating the ecosystem for so long, I think. And as Hollywood studios continue to prove how out of touch they are with what people are feeling in this country and the world as a whole, I think we're going to see a larger disconnect between, you know, their success and their impact on cinema as a whole and the people who go out there and inspire their audience and their fellow creators to go out and make an uncompromised vision and to trust themselves and to trust their ideas and to really pursue their passion and their creativity. And that, I think, is what Matt Farley is all about. That is what Moturn Media and the Moturn Method is all about. As long as he's continuing to put out like one or two of these movies a year, Matt is going to be one of my favorite filmmakers working today in the world. And yeah, I mean, I can't imagine much higher praise than that. Matt, if you hear this episode, because I'm going to send it to you, we really loved your movie, and I would love to have you back on the podcast again.
Shout out North Shore, shout out Danvers, Massachusetts, shout out Bishop Fenwick. That's where Matt went. That's where my aunt went. I went to St. John's Prep. Shout out North Shore Roast Beef. Shout out the Celtics. Matt's the best. I haven't spoken to him yet, but I should give him a call sometime.
Thank you for not shouting out the Red Sox. Yeah,
well,
no.
He has a Celtics podcast. So
he does, that's true.
I was kind of doing that, but I will also shout out the Red Sox.
I won't.
Always. I'm just glad you and Brody are convinced that Soto is going to re-sign with the Yankees. I wouldn't have had it any other way.
We'll see, man. His father and brother liked Aaron Judge's MVP post today on Instagram. So the speculators be speculating. But
I love a good speculation.
Yeah, no, shout out to all of those people that you named. Shout out to none of the sports teams, but everything else. Shout out to you, Tony, for being here again and for being on board for another episode of Mudville at the Movies, which we are going to go back to making a much more regular thing. We're going to be back talking about another movie soon. That's going to do it for us here today. Thank you so much for listening to Mudville at the Movies. Brody and I will be back later in the week talking about Sean Baker's Red Rocket. Get ready for that. We've got a lot coming out over here at the Mudville Pod. And we want to shout out all of you beautiful people who stayed to the end with us today. I have been one of your hosts, Nolan Rabin.
And I'm Tony Brown. It's a beautiful day for the movies.
Thank you guys so much, and goodbye.